no sense.
This is the Relic Radio Show, old-time radio entertainment still standing the test of time, from RelicRadio.com. Welcome back to the Relic Radio Show. Thanks for joining me this Tuesday for another 60 minutes of radio drama. We'll begin with Theater 5, their episode from January 26, 1965, titled Mr. Horn's Holiday. After that, it's Your Army Air Forces and Blind Landings, their episode from September 20th, 1945.
Theater 5 presents Mr. Horn's Holiday.
Gentlemen, the world catastrophe is ended. But as you know only too well, civilization had a narrow squeak last year. Now that we've returned to normal, I must tell you what brought mankind to the brink of chaos, because in a way, I was responsible for it. To begin with, my name is Travis Webster, and I'm a painter. Not one of those far-out painters. My stuff is conventional. Seascapes, beach scenes, things like that. So I've had a hard time selling my work. Anyway, a little over a year ago, I finished a painting of the California beach and bungalow where I live with my wife, Helen, and submitted it to an art contest in competition for a $10,000 prize. I had 6 months to wait before the winning canvas would be announced, and meanwhile, Helen and I had a rough time trying to get our bills paid.
Travis, dear, something's bound to happen soon. I feel sure of it. So please try not to feel so depressed and miserable.
I'm sorry, sweetheart, but I can't seem to snap out of it. After all, I'm supposed to be the breadwinner of this combination. Some breadwinner.
But we do have this bungalow and our beach and ocean. Travis, I've just had a sublime brain flash.
Oh?
Weary people plus their money equals ecstasy.
What does that mean?
We have a lovely spare room. So why don't we advertise for a guest? A paying guest.
Oh, no, Helen. That would be too big a burden on you.
No, I think it'd be exciting. I'm going to do it. I'm going to run an ad in our local paper.
Well, for about 5 months, we ran the ad in our local paper, but no rush of weary travelers. Until one morning when Helen was checking our ad in the paper.
Travis, did you see this?
See what?
This announcement on the art page. Here, look.
Oh, what's it about?
The $10,000 art contest.
Hey, I'd almost forgotten about that contest.
So had I, but here's the announcement about it. See? Right here at the bottom of the page.
Yeah. Yeah, it says the winner's going to be announced tomorrow.
Goodness, aren't you excited?
Well, sure, a little. But my painting hasn't got a chance.
Now, why do you say that?
Because it's too conventional, even though I think it's one of the best things I've ever done.
Then it has a chance to win. Oh, wouldn't you just love to win all that lovely money?
I'm sure I would, sweetheart, more than anything in the world. I'd sell my soul to win that $10,000. Yeah, just like Faust, I'd sell my soul. If Satan himself were to drive up right now, I'd willingly make a deal with him.
Travis!
Holy smoke.
Hi there! Is that the Webster residence?
Yes, I'm Travis Webster. Drive right up here to the steps.
Sure thing.
I don't recognize him. Do you, Travis?
No, but... he turns out to be Satan. I was only kidding.
Whoever he is, he certainly arrived on cue. Gives me the shivers. I'm covered with goosebumps.
Oh, I don't mind admitting that Helen and I were a bit startled by the stranger's arrival at just that moment. He was a short, smiling, middle-aged man, dressed and equipped like the typical American tourist. He wore a cap, sunglasses, and a wild Hawaiian shirt. And among the luggage in the back seat of his sports convertible were camera equipment and a bag of golf clubs. We walked down the steps to meet him as he stepped out of his car.
Well, now, this is great. Simply great. What a magnificent location.
Yes, isn't it? Oh, I'm Helen Webster.
Well, greetings to both of you. My name's Horn.
Horn? You mean it?
Yep, Harry Horn. If you'd help me unload the back seat, I'd be much obliged, okay?
Yes, sure.
Now, I don't know if you realize it, Helen, my dear, but you've got a guest for your spare room.
Well, no, Mr. Horn, I didn't realize that. But you're certainly welcome.
Fine. I'm going to be very happy here, I'm sure.
You saw our advertisement in the paper?
That's right. I was driving up the coast, hunting for a spot to spend a long vacation, when I saw your ad, and I knew this was the perfect place for old Harry Horn. This bungalow, the location, and you young Websters suit me to a T. The only question is, do I suit the young Websters?
Well, of course you do.
Well, that's good, because I'm planning to stay a year.
A whole year?
Yes, Travis, this is my sabbatical. And I'm not going to do a blessed thing for 12 months but eat, sleep, swim, and play golf. Well, while I'm thinking of it, take this envelope, will you?
Sure. What's in it?
Money, cash, payment in advance for a year.
Oh, that is necessary, Mr. Horn. I mean, you can pay by the week if you'd rather.
But I wouldn't rather. This is my year off, and I don't even want to think about money. And now, if you'll just carry these belongings to my room, I'm going down and wade in the ocean. I haven't had my feet in salt water for ages and ages.
Travis, how much is in that envelope?
Oh, I'll see. Holy cow!
What's the matter?
Helen, it's a pair of $1,000 bills.
What? I think I'm going to faint.
Well, if you're going to do that, wait till we get inside. I'll take the suitcases. You carry the golf bag.
All right, if I can.
Oh, watch out!
I'm sorry. I was too weak to hold it.
Well, stand the bag up and I'll put the clubs back.
Say, these are expensive clubs.
Goodness, what kind of a golf club is that?
It isn't a golf club at all. It's a small pitchfork.
Next morning, while our strange guest was out for a stroll, I received a registered letter from the judges of the art contest. It informed me that my painting had won the prize, and attached to the letter was a check for $10,000. When Helen saw the check, she almost collapsed.
Travis, I can't believe it. Is it real?
Yeah, sure it is, Helen. I've won.
I knew you would, darling. I was sure you... Oh, my goodness.
What's the matter?
Mr. Horn.
Uh-oh. Do you really think that he... Where is he?
I'm right here, Travis. Congratulations, my boy.
What for, Mr. Horn?
Winning the prize. I'm delighted.
But, Mr. Horn, how did you know Travis won?
Because I arranged it, naturally. Or perhaps I should have said supernaturally.
Then you really are who we think you are?
You know very well I am.
But why did you come here?
I told you to enjoy a year of relaxation, and believe me, I've earned a sabbatical. You have no idea of the problem that arises in my place of business. After millenniums of working like a demon, with no time off, I'm worn to a frazzle.
But, Mr. Horn, why did you come to this exact spot?
Well, that was sort of a coincidence. I just read your advertisement for a paying guest. When I became aware of your husband's statement that he'd willingly make a deal with me in order to win the contest. So, of course, I came instantly.
Oh!
Oh, now, come now, my dear. There's no need to carry on like this. You should be overjoyed. After all, Travers won the contest. He has $10,000.
Yes, but now you own Travis's soul.
Oh, that's nonsense. Forget it.
But you do own my soul, Mr. Horn.
Fiddlesticks. I don't need your soul, Travis. I'm up to my neck in souls. And to be frank with you,
I'm pretty tired of that seedy Faust bargain, so keep your soul and your prize money and don't mention them again, okay? But I'm not going to let you back out on our bargain. I paid in advance for a year, and I'm staying for a year. So let's not hear any more about it.
After all, Travis, Mr. Horn has been our benefactor. Without his influence, you mightn't have won the contest.
Well, maybe not. But I must admit, my painting was superb. It really deserved to win. I think.
And so Mr. Horn's holiday began. During the months that followed, we never mentioned our Faustian bargain, and Mr. Horn became our pleasant and fascinating companion. One evening before dinner, the three of us were sitting on the porch, relaxing over drinks.
May I fix you another highball, Mr. Horn?
Yes, Helen, you may. For a reason that should be obvious, I've become quite fond of firewater.
Say, how do you like that sunset? You ever seen anything to match those fiery colors?
Not on Earth, Travis. Not on Earth.
No, I suppose not.
Here you are, Mr. Horn. Just the way you like it. Not too much water.
Thank you, my dear.
You're frowning. Penny for your thoughts.
Eh? Oh, I was thinking about what's happening down home.
Oh, what is happening?
Oh, my junior assistants are messing things up rather badly. You know how it is when the boss is absent. They let the business go to Hades, as the saying goes.
Well, Travis and I certainly can't complain about that. Since you've been away from headquarters, some pretty wonderful things have been happening here on Earth.
Wonderful is hardly the word for it. I'd say phenomenal.
Yeah, I agree. But mankind has never had it so good.
That's true. Everything is changing in your favor. Take the matter of sin, for example. Have you noticed that sin no longer exists on Earth? That it's been replaced by morality? That nations and governments have discarded suspicion and belligerence and offer nothing now but the warm hand of friendship?
Yes, Mr. Horn, it's absolutely incredible.
Why, even the Russians are congenial. And I assure you, that took some doing. And juvenile delinquency, where has that gone? It's vanished, of course. And respect for parents has taken its place. Shady business deals, bribery, corruption. What's happened to them? All are gone. Wiped out. Avarice, lust, depravity. Banished. Competition and conflict. Done away with. Even killing for food has come to an abrupt end. Neither humans nor animals will commit murder for the appeasement of hunger. I don't mean to boast, my friends, but for the first time in history, everyone everywhere is unafflicted, unvexed, and unplagued. Well, dear me, I'm afraid your firewater has loosened my tongue. Forgive me. That was a terribly long speech. Devilishly long.
While the land flowed with milk and honey, it never occurred to Helen and me that the paradise on Earth might one day come to an end. But to our dismay, in the course of a few short weeks, a terrifying reaction began to take place. Without meat on the table, meals became a vegetarian bore. Butchers, packers, and cattle raisers were destitute. Owing to the disappearance of sin and vice, policemen, soldiers, lawyers, locksmiths, even representatives of the United Nations, found themselves without work. To make matters worse, without conflict, there was no drama. And with no drama in life, everyone became bored, bored, bored. And in addition to boredom, our hearts were filled with stark, shattering fear.
Travis, I'm afraid. Desperately afraid.
I know, darling. I am too.
Look, there are animals walking on the beach. Deer, rabbits, cattle. That's never happened before.
No. The animals are multiplying and overrunning the earth. The whole world is facing disaster, Helen, and you and I are the only living beings who know the reason why.
We've got to do something about it. I mean this minute.
Yes, yes, darling, I agree. Mr. Horn has got to leave here and go back to Haiti.
My ears are burning. You must have been talking about me.
Mr. Horn, get out. I'm afraid of you.
What? Afraid of little old me? Why, Helen, I'm surprised at you.
Now, look, this is no laughing matter.
It is to me, Travis. I'm terribly amused.
But we're not. We're just plain scared. You know very well the chaos you've caused, so I want you to pack up and get out of here at once.
But, my dear boy, where do you want me to go?
Well, for all I care, you can go to...
You can't say the word, can you, Travers? Nobody swears anymore. What a pity.
Mr. Horn, will you please go away, for heaven's sake?
For heaven's sake, my dear Helen? I've never done anything for the sake of that district in my whole long career.
Oh, look, Mr. Horn, be reasonable. Your holiday from Hades has turned into a catastrophe on Earth. Doesn't that bother you just a little?
On the contrary. As I told you, it amuses me.
Amuses you? The misery you've caused amuses you?
Of course, my dear. And it pleases me as well. Well,
that's rot. How can it possibly please you?
Well, believe it or not, Travers, even I have a trace of egotism in my makeup. So I'm rather flattered to see that my talents, peculiar as they are, still bring results at this stage of my existence. You see, my dear friends, no one on Earth has ever had a speck of use for me. But soon, if you broadcast the news of my presence here, everyone will realize that I have a definite place in the universal scheme. I was created for one precise purpose: to make man's life exciting, competitive, and dramatic. I'm told that mosquitoes were created for the same reason. But that's beside the point. The point is, I refuse to cut my holiday short.
A few days later, when life had become almost intolerable, Helen and I decided once again to implore Mr. Horn to leave. To our surprise, owing to our abject pleading, he seemed to be less adamant than before.
Look, will you please get off your knees? You're breaking my heart.
Then you'll go, Mr. Horn? You'll really go away?
Well, I can't promise. But do you know something strange? Nobody's ever prayed to me before. I must confess, I'm touched.
So you do have some human feelings after all. Well, that gives us hope, Mr. Horn. Please don't let us down.
Oh, it isn't a matter of letting you down, Travers. I'm thinking of my holiday. How would you like to have your vacation ruined?
Well, I wouldn't like it any more than I'd like to return my $10,000 prize, but I'll make a deal with you.
Oh, no. Not your soul again.
No, my prize. I really need that money, Mr. Horn, but if you'll promise to leave here right now, I'll send the money back. What's more, I'll give you back the cash you paid us for the year's rent.
Fiddle faddle, I won't accept it. Give it to charity. Give it to charity? Did I really say that?
Yes, you did. And I think it's just wonderful.
Well, then I'd better get out of here before I turn into a complete millsop. Travers, bring my car around. I'll start the packing.
It took Mr. Horn 10 minutes to pack up and get behind the wheel of his car. Helen and I went out to bid him farewell.
Well, dear friends, this is an unhappy moment for me. Back I go to the old grind with only a smidgen of a vacation. Don't you pity me just a little?
Yes, we do, Mr. Horn. I'm sorry it turned out this way, but Travis and I think you're very sweet. Don't we, Travis?
Yes, in a way, you're a real good Joe. But don't look so gloomy, Mr. Horn. It makes me feel guilty.
Guilty? Are you kidding? Don't be naive.
What's so funny?
I just thought of a joke. And it's on you and Helen.
What kind of a joke?
Oh, a real devilish one. If you'll excuse the expression. The fact is, friends, I plan to leave now anyway. This wasn't a holiday at all. It was a project. All worked out to the minute in the most intricate detail.
What are you talking about?
Well, just between us and the lamppost, every step of this caper was planned deliberately. to make people appreciate me and realize my value. You dig?
Yeah, we dig.
Good. I'm off, then.
Safe journey, Mr. Horn.
Oh, thanks, sweetie. Oh, before I shove off, do you lovely people want to know a charming secret? In all my eons of committing mischief, I've never had so much doggone fun. Arrivederci.
So long, Mr. Horn.
And so, ladies and gentlemen, that's why our world returned so quickly to normal. Now, I beg you not to judge Mr. Horn too harshly for the near catastrophe, or myself either, because I did try to make amends. I returned my $10,000, but the contest judges sent it right back. They said my painting would have won anyway without Mr. Horn's intervention. And perhaps art itself is returning to normal. Who knows? And that makes Helen and me very happy indeed. Arrivederci.
Has presented Mr. Horn's Holiday, written by Albert G. Miller, produced and directed by Ted Bell. In the cast, David Burns, June Graham, and George Petrie. Script editor, Jack C. Wilson. Original music by Alexander Vlastotsenko. Orchestra under the direction of Glenn Osser. This is Fred Foy speaking. Has been an ABC Radio Network production.
To keep the peace, to pioneer the future, the new mission of your AAF. In cooperation with the American Broadcasting Company, the Army Air Forces presents Your AAF, a report to the American people on its continuing operations today throughout the world and their adventures in research, which are pioneering for your better world tomorrow. Tonight you will hear from Wright Field, the AAF's vast research laboratory, an actual blind landing made by a pilot who never touched the controls. From Washington, Lieutenant Colonel Louis T. Grayson, answering directly a mother's questions about her soldier son. From Japan, an interview with Generals Giles, LeMay, and O'Donnell before the first non-stop flight from Japan to the United States. And from Washington, the first radio pickup of their arrival. And as always, the singing voices in the orchestra of the AAF, bringing you the best of the top music of the day. And from the All Told You Orchestra, it's a tune in the tempo of the time. Get happy. Thank you. Wrightfield, Dayton, Ohio, the vast research laboratories of the AAF, backbone of American air might. Notable among Wrightfield's achievements are the many safety devices developed during war to protect our airmen, all of which now become part of our daily lives. One of the most exciting of these is a device to land planes under any weather conditions entirely by radio control and without any assistance from the pilot. Your AAF takes you now by Army wire recorder to the completely hooded pilot's compartment of an Army plane now approaching Wright Field. To describe this landing, your AAF radio correspondent, Captain Bob Van Kamp. Go ahead, Captain.
This is your AAF reporter, Captain Bob Van Kamp, speaking from the pilot's compartment of the Flying Bat, a C-47 airplane flying at 2,000 feet, somewhere about 7 miles from Wright Field. In just a moment, we're going to attempt one of the most unusual broadcasts ever made. We're going to tell you just what happens as this great transport plane comes in for a completely automatic landing, without human hands touching the controls. The windshield of our Flying Bat is hooded by black cloth. It's impossible to see outside. Our pilot, Captain Dick Orchard of Lakewood, Ohio, is going to use an automatic pilot, which has been coordinated with the standard instrument approach system of the AAF. The system was developed by the Air Technical Service Command to make airplane landings simpler and safer, regardless of weather conditions. At this moment, two different radio beams are being sent out from the runway area at Wright Field. One marks the center of the runway, and the other indicates the descending path that our plane should take for its landing. All Captain Orchard needs to do is get on these two beams and then put his plane on automatic pilot. Mechanical brains will do the rest. Let's listen now to the landing preparations underway.
Right tower, this is Blind Bat, over.
Blind Bat, this is Right Tower, over.
Right tower, this is Blind Bat, 7 miles west at 2,000. Request clearance for automatic approach and landing, over.
Blind Bat, this is Right Tower. Blind Bat, this is Right Tower. You are cleared for approach and landing. Over.
Right Tower, this is Blind Bat. Roger, out.
Captain, what happens now that you're cleared by Wright Field for this automatic landing?
I'll turn on the automatic approach, and from now on, until we land, the Blind Bat will fly itself.
Say, I can feel this airplane banking and turning as it gets set. That means the automatic pilot has taken hold, huh? What do you do now, Captain Orchard?
All we have to do now is sit tight and watch the instrument panel and get ready for the final landing. Let's make our landing check now, Max.
Okay. Gear down and locked. High RPM, 20 degrees of flap. Booster pumps are on. Hydraulic pressure's up. Trim set.
On the instrument panel, a little vertical needle can be seen exactly centered on the indicator dial. That shows that we're right in line with the runway at Wright Field. Another horizontal needle tells us that we're descending at just the right angle. That's where this automatic pilot has it all over manual landing. You know you're coming in just right.
Right tower. This is Brian Bat on final. Over.
Brian Bat, this is Right Tower. You're clear to land. Over.
Right tower, this is Brian Bat. Roger, out.
How close are we now, Captain Orchard?
Less than 4 miles now, maybe 3.
How can you tell?
See this light just above the indicator?
Uh-huh.
It flashed 2 times a second just before I called the tower. When we get 1 mile out, it will start flashing 6 times a second. When we're down to 50 feet over the end of the runway, it will burn continuously.
Our blacked-out C-47 is going down at approximately 400 feet a minute, and believe me, that's fast when you're under a hood. In case you're interested in the brains behind this new development, credit for combining these two great safety features goes to Lieutenant Colonel F.L. Mosley, Chief of the Communications and Navigation Laboratory at Wright Field. Thanks to him and the engineers under his direction in the radio and radar subdivision, this new system for easy, safe, blind landings should soon prove a boon to civilian pilots, and in fact to every person who flies in the air age of tomorrow. This is really an eerie feeling, knowing that the Earth is coming up at you and not being able to see it. There goes that light. It's flashing faster now. We've 1 mile to go, and the ground is just 200 feet below. Both pilots are watching their instruments intently. Brother, that ground is getting close. It won't be long now. If everything goes okay, we'll be hitting the runway soon. The light's steady now. The altimeter shows 50 feet. Falling fast. 25 feet now. Get set. Here we go, down to the runway.
There we are.
We made it. We're rolling on the runway. It was a perfect landing. Now let's tear off the hood and look out. Yes, sir, we're lined up perfectly on the runway. And that's how the automatic pilot ties in with the AAF's instrument approach system.
From Wright Field, we return you now to your AAF in New York.
Thank you, Wright Field, for another notable contribution toward the safety of the future. Just 10 years ago, Wright Field was already peering into the future, and the first automatic pilots were being tested. 10 years ago, in 1935, when the only piloting most of us were doing was the girlfriend around the dance floor, or steering her outside to look at such natural phenomena as Sergeant Bob Carroll and the singing voices of the AAF described for you. Blue Moon.
You saw me standing alone, without a dream in my heart, without a love of my own. You knew just what I was there for.
Washington, D.C., the Army Air Forces operates the Personnel Services Division, one of whose functions is the matter of insurance. Typical of the questions asked by soldiers and their dependents are those of Mrs. Philip R. Strizik, whose son is now serving in the Philippines with the 5th Air Force. Mrs. Strizik has come here tonight to get some advice concerning her son's National Service Life Insurance. And standing by in Washington, D.C. to help her in this matter is Lieutenant Colonel Lewis J. Grayson, an outstanding authority on the insurance problems of Air Force's personnel. Mrs. Strizik, Colonel Grayson is ready for your first question.
Colonel, my son will soon be a civilian, and we are trying to decide what he should do about his $10,000 National Service Life Insurance. He is single, and he has nobody dependent upon him for support. For his own good, should he keep all his insurance, reduce it, or drop it entirely when he is discharged?
Well, Mrs. Strizek, someday your son will undoubtedly get married and raise a family. When that time comes, he will need and want all the insurance he can carry. However, he may then find himself unable to obtain insurance from a private company except at a very high cost, if at all, because of unsatisfactory physical condition or because of hazardous employment. He therefore should keep the insurance he now has, at least until such time after discharge from the Army as he can judge his needs and income.
Should he keep it in its present form as long as he can, Colonel Grayson, or convert it now to ordinary life or some other permanent plan?
That is an individual problem, Mrs. Strizek, depending upon your son's ability to pay premiums. The sooner he converts it, the lower the premiums will be. There is an advantage, therefore, in converting his insurance as soon after discharge from the Army, as he is well established in a civilian job and knows what he needs and can afford. Convert to ordinary life, 20 payment life, or 30 payment life.
In the event my son marries after leaving the service, can he name his wife beneficiary in place of me without a lot of red tape?
Yes, by simply sending a written request over his signature to the Veterans Administration, stating his policy number or serial number, his wife's full name, and the amount of insurance.
One last question, Colonel. Does National Service Life Insurance ordinarily cost less than similar insurance with a private company?
In National Service Life Insurance, the government pays all the costs of administration. Also, the government pays all the excess losses due to military or naval service. These savings are passed on to the policyholders. It is probable, therefore, that this government insurance is the lowest cost insurance your son can get for his money.
Thanks very much, Colonel Grayson.
Not at all, Mrs. Strizek. I hope we've helped you and your son.
We return you now to your AAF in New York.
To many a returning airman these days, the rhythm of the clicking train wheels makes a kind of music. And here's the air crew to give you an idea of just how that music sounds.
Down the line, I figured out a tender number 49. She's the only one that'll sound that way.
On the edge of the speaker, Santa Fe.
See the old smoke rising round the bend. I reckon that she knows she ought to meet a friend. Folks around these parts get the time of day.
From the Atchison to Big of the Santa Fe.
Here she comes. Ooh, 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 ooh. Hey, Jim, you better get the red. Ooh, 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 ooh. She's got a list of passengers that's pretty big. And they'll all want to live in the Brown Hotel. Cause lots of them been traveling for quite a spell. All the way from Philadelphia. On the app to Santa Pega and the Santa Fe. The app to Santa Pega and the Santa Fe.
Do you hear that whistle down the line? Think of that it's engine 49. The only one that'll sound that way.
On the at the Santa Pega and the Santa Fe.
See the old smoke rising round the bend. Reckon that you're gonna meet a friend. Folks around these parts get the time of day.
From the at the Santa Pega and the Santa Fe.
Here she comes. right, clickety-choo-choo-choo.
Hey, Jim, you better get the rig.
Chugging along, singing a song, clickety-choo-choo-choo.
She's got a list of passengers that's pretty big.
And they all want lifts to Brown's Hotel.
Because lots of them been traveling for quite a spell.
All the way from Philadelphia.
On the edge of Santa Topeka.
Santa Fe.
On the edge of Santa Topeka.
Santa Fe. Atchison. Topeka and Santa Fe.
Of this week, three B-29s wheeled into the air off a Japanese airfield and started on one of the most epoch-making flights in nation history, the first non-stop flight from Japan to America. To hear direct from Generals Giles, LeMay, and O'Donnell on the object of this flight and their reactions before making it, we take you now by Army wire recorder to Mitsutani Airfield, Japan. Go ahead, Major West.
This is your AAF reporter, Major Carol West, speaking from Mizutani Airfield near Chitose on the island of Hokkaido, Japan. In a few hours, a new era of peacetime long-range air transportation will begin as three B-29s roar down this runway for the start of one of the longest non-stop flights in history, all the way from the Japanese Empire to Washington, D.C. These super fortresses will be flown by three colorful Army Air Forces figures. Lieutenant General Barney M. Giles, Deputy Commander of the United States Army Strategic Air Forces. Major General Curtis E. LeMay, Chief of Staff of the Strategic Air Forces and former Commander of the 20th Air Force. And Brigadier General Emmett O'Donnell, Commander of the Veteran 73rd Bombardment Wing of the 20th Air Force. We have these three men at our wire recording microphone. They have agreed to supply some information about this flight. General Giles, just what is the purpose of this flight?
The purpose of this flight is to study the feasibility of using the northern route between Japan and the United States, paying particular attention to communication, navigation, and weather.
General Giles, how long do you think it would take a person to make the same trip by the usual water and land route?
I would say from 4 to 5 weeks.
Sir, how much gasoline will you each be carrying when you take off?
Each airplane will have slightly more than 10,000 gallons of gasoline.
Well, figuring about 6.5 pounds per gallon, that will be around 65,000 pounds weight or 32 tons. Is that right?
Yes, you are correct.
How long is this airstrip, General LeMay?
8,200 feet long.
Is that plenty of room for you to get airborne with your load?
Not plenty, but it's adequate.
Is the runway in pretty good condition, sir?
Yes, this aerodrome has never been bombed, so the runway is in fairly good condition.
General O'Donnell, why was this airfield picked for the start of the flight?
It was selected because it's the only aerodrome in Japan which is adequate for fully loaded B-29 takeoffs.
Did the Japanese use this field for long-range air operations?
Not to our knowledge, but we understand that the Japanese had a project for launching one-way, four-engine bomber kamikaze attacks from this field against our aircraft industry on the West Coast.
Sir, what proportion of the flight will be over water?
Approximately one-third of it.
General LeMay, do you anticipate good weather all the way?
In making a flight of this distance, it's impossible to find atmospheric conditions that will give you good weather throughout the entire route. We expect to have bad weather over a portion of the route.
How were your crews picked for this flight, General Giles?
All of these crews completed 35 missions or more against the enemy, and they were scheduled to go back to the States on normal rotation.
One more question, sir. Will you carry our wire recording to Washington in your B-29?
Yes, Major West. We will be very glad to accommodate you.
Thank you, Lieutenant General Barney M. Giles, Major General Curtis E. LeMay, and Brigadier General Emmett O'Donnell for giving us information on your history-making flight. May we wish you good luck and Godspeed. This is your AAF reporter returning you to the United States.
In the lead plane of this flight, carried from Japan to Washington in a matter of some 28 hours, was the wire recording you have just heard. In Washington, to pick it up and to cover the landing, was our AAF reporter, Captain Howard Finch. For his eyewitness report of the landing, we take you now by Army wire recorder to Washington and Captain Howard Finch.
This is your AAF reporter, Captain Howard Finch, speaking from the Gravelly Point Airport of the ATC in Washington, D.C. Yesterday at 4:01 p.m. Eastern Wartime, three silver battle-tested B-29s roared off the runways of Mitsutani Field on the Japanese home islands of Hokkaido and headed toward the United States on a great circle route that was destined to carry them over one quarter of the distance around the Earth's surface. Fierce headwinds were encountered over northern Canada today, which necessitated the use of more fuel than anticipated, with the result that the Super Fort landed at Chicago, refueled, and just a few moments ago landed in Washington, and are now taxiing to the apron here in front of the ATC terminal. And the crowd is milling around. The first man out of the B-29, Lieutenant General Barney Giles. He looks a little tired, but he's smiling and seems very happy. And we're going to try and get our microphones up here where we can pick up some of the official greeting. The crew of the first B-29 are now beginning to file out of the airplane. There is a terrific crowd milling around the plane now, and congratulations being roared out. Bands are playing in the background. The individual members of the crew are being congratulated. General Arnold is talking to General Giles. And now one of the crew members of the B-29s that have just landed. What is your name?
Leo Miller, sir.
And what's your rank, Leo?
Staff Sergeant.
And what was your job on the B-29?
I was one of the two radio operators that came along to carry on communications between air-to-air and air-to-ground.
And which ship, Sergeant?
Number 3, sir.
Where's your hometown?
Brooklyn, New York.
Now, how does it feel to be back now?
It feels great to be back in civilization again, for one thing.
Where were you stationed, Sergeant?
Saipan in the Marianas, 73rd Wing.
And what are your plans for the future?
Well, I intend to go to college, University of Minnesota to be exact.
I'm the flight sergeant. What was the one thing that thrilled you perhaps the most?
Well, we saw three Russian fighter planes up by Siberia that recognized us and rattled their wings and then took off. And it was great to look down on those American cities again, Chicago and Washington at night.
Good. Thank you very much, Sergeant. And now, ladies and gentlemen, General of the Army, H.H. Arnold.
I want to tell you, Barney, and Rosie, and Kurt, that I'm very proud of the flight that you made. The crews and the planes and the leaders all lived up to our expectations. We knew that the B-29 was good because we saw what happened in Japan. But we didn't know whether or not it could make this long flight back to the United States. And in spite of the headwinds, you made a wonderful flight. And I want to congratulate all of you.
So, Arnold, thanks very much for your congratulations. You not only think the airplane is all right, I talked to a number of Jap pilots and the head of the Japanese Air Force. He said the B-29, the best bomber in the world.
General Arnold,
you ought to know.
General Arnold, what is the true significance of this flight from Japan to the United States?
The true significance of the flight was to give a real workout to the B-29 to see what it could do in the way of traveling long distances until we could get some idea of the distance to be covered and the time it would require to cover the distances. We need that information for the future to figure out just what we can expect of airplanes of this type.
Thank you, sir. General LeMay, anything of an unusual nature happen on the flight?
No, everything functioned perfectly. If it hadn't been for the headwind, we'd been here. Actually, we flew more air miles than was necessary to make the trip.
Where did you first hit the headwind?
We hit them all the way. Only 20 miles all the way across.
Thank you, sir. General O'Donnell, at what height did you fly coming across in the main?
We started out rather low and worked up to 25,000 feet, which is the highest we attained.
Landing at Chicago and coming into Washington, at what height did you fly in from there?
We flew in formation at 9,000 feet.
Anything of an unusual nature?
No, nothing at all. Nothing at all, except that we were intercepted by two Russian fighter pilots and P-63s off Kamchatka, who gave us a big high ball and waved their wings at us and sent us on our way.
And the United States looked mighty, mighty good.
It surely does.
Thank you, sir. And that about concludes the ceremonies of welcoming these three heroic crews who have landed here at Gravelly Airport of the ATC in the nation's capital at Washington, D.C. We return you now to your AAF in New York.
To keep the peace, to pioneer the future, this is your AAF. During the last half hour, you've been listening to the official program of the Army Air Forces, your AAF, which came to you from New York City. This is the American Broadcasting Company.
That's it for the Relic Radio Show this week. I'll be back next Tuesday with another one. And between now and then, you can find more from Theater 5, your Army Air Force's past episodes of the Relic Radio Show and everything else Relic Radio at the website relicradio.com. You'll also find our Shoutcast stream there and our donate button if you'd like to help support this and all the shows. Your support makes it all possible. And thanks, as always, to those who have. Thanks for joining me today. Talk to you again next week with another episode of the Relic Radio Show.